Session number 17965, Sergeant Major Frederick Beadle, Reel 12.
Sergeant Major Beadle, Reel 12. And we skipped ahead a bit. When you went out on the draft to the Middle East, how did you get there?
A very interesting journey, actually. We embarked in Liverpool, went across the Atlantic down to Brazil, docked there for a couple of days. We weren't allowed out individually, but we did go out in squads and march around the little town. From there, we went to South Africa, Durban. And we had about 10 days in Durban. And then we went from Durban up to Port Suez by boat again.
Same boat or by a different one?
A very different one. The one that we went from Liverpool to South Africa was the... what was that line called? One lovely boat. I can't remember the name. Stirling Castle. Stirling Castle, that was the Castle line. It's a beautiful boat. And the journey from Durban to Egypt was a rough old boat, there was no doubt about that. It rolled about all over the show. I spent Christmas Day on that as guard commander, up in the nose of the boat where the jar was. And it got more rocking than anywhere else, I think. And then we were taken by a train to this depot on the Suez, but the name of the place I can't remember, where the PT school was there at the time. That's a Middle East PT school. And we were sent out from there to whichever units it was decided we should go to.
On that voyage, did the Stirling Castle travel on its own, or was it part of a convoy?
Oh, it was a convoy. Yes, we were sent across out the way. I mean, we realised afterwards why we went across there. We'd been back in 1942 when the North African invasion had started, with the Yanks and that coming in. So we were keeping out the way of them, as well as trying to keep out the way of the submarines as well.
Did you have any alerts while you were on the voyage?
No, not at all, not at all. A wonderful, comfortable voyage.
What were your quarters like on Stirling Castle?
Well, as you can well imagine, places like the ballrooms and that, they went to spare. They were done in three-tier bunks. Every bit of space was taken with those right the way through the ship, where they could fit them in. And that's how they slept them all.
What about you? Where were you?
The same as everybody else.
What about the food on the ship?
Now, isn't that strange? Now, you've asked me about food on the trip, and I can't remember what the food was like. Now, isn't that stupid? Yep. It couldn't have been outstanding one way or the other, could it? If it had been very bad, I would have remembered it. And if it had been even better than good, I would have remembered it. I can't remember what the meals consisted of.
How did you keep yourself occupied on that voyage to
South Africa? Oh, the usual thing. We did a bit of PT, of course. I mean, we took the rest of the troops for half hour here and half hour there on PT, doing close combat and things like that. Unarmed combat, etc., which passed our way a bit. Then the inevitable housey-housey. Other than that, you set about and read if you could find something to read.
Could you find something to read?
Not to my memory, no.
You mentioned unarmed combat. Yeah. The first time you mentioned it, had you been doing that before, or was it something new?
We had an officer, when I was at the Warwick depot, we had a Warwickshire officer come into the depot. He was keeping fit, and he was very, very good at unarmed combat. He was a judo expert, so naturally he was good at unarmed combat. And so I got together with him, and he taught me all the elementary parts of combat. After that, I took my instructors on that, so everybody in the gym knew all about it. And if I wanted to do it with the troops, I had chaps there trained who could do it. And most interesting, I don't know who had passed the word around, but I had a person representing the Coventry Police come along and see me and asked me if I would take the police there on Sunday mornings on close combat. So that was very interesting. They come up with a truck and pick up the mats and that from my gymnasium and me, take me to Coventry, which I would put them through an hour's training, give me a glass of beer and bring me home again.
Were they good at it?
The police, oh, they varied like anybody else. It's funny enough, the middle of the line sort of chap did a better job than a very big bloke. Big blokes were not quite so quick and a bit awkward, I found. That doesn't go for all big blokes, of course, but generally speaking, the middle of the road chap, 12 stone, 40 chest, 42 chest, that sort of chap, seemed to be the best type of chap on it. But with the unarmed combat, anybody, regardless of their weight and strength, provided they do the thing properly, they could do all the various exercises there were.
What was the aim of it? Was it to make the physical training more interesting, or was it, did it have some other purpose?
Well, it did make it more interesting for people to do this sort of thing. It was a good thing for the troops to know. I mean, it's a bit beyond imagination that one got down to the state where one was grappling with a German and using unarmed combat on him. But I suppose it could have happened in various places, no doubt about it. I think, too, it was a good confidence builder. That was one of the main things. You get a chap who's not all that strong in that, and he finds that by just doing a little movement he can throw a chap over onto his back. It gives him a hell of a lot of confidence compared to what he might have had as a bit of a weakling. I think probably that's the main thing. It's a confidence builder more than anything else. And something of interest, of course, in the gymnasium. Oh, shoulder, trunk, leg exercises don't go down very well all the time. You've got to mix it with something.
You mentioned that you called in at Brazil. What impression did you get of Brazil? When you were in Brazil,
yes,
on the way, what impression did you get of Brazil?
Well, I didn't get much of an impression at all because I didn't see much of it. We docked. And when we were given a march round, we off the boat onto the quayside, we marched uphill all the time to an area where there was some building and a big green centrepiece of grass. We was halted there and stayed there for about half an hour. Then we marched back again, down the hill, onto the boat. I remember the down the hill march more than the up the hill, because on the way back down to the boat, we were overlooked by flats going up to some height. And God bless the people there. They thought they were being kind, but as we marched back down the hill, they showered us with books all tied up in bundles. It's a bit of a job dodging around, getting out of the way of them. But it came in very well, because everybody picked up the books that was going, and if they could get hold of them. They probably gave a lot of people a lot of hours pleasure of reading, I expect.
And what happened when you were in Durban? What did they do with you there for that 10 days?
We went out onto the race course. There was a train ride from Durban out to this race course. We had pretty ad-lib free time there to go into Durban as often as we liked. They were very kind, the people in South Africa in those days. For instance, before we went round to Durban, we stopped at the port where you see the Table Mountain.
Cape Town.
We stopped at Cape Town. We didn't get off the boat there, but this rather large lady who sings well, she was on the pier side singing all the old songs to us. Now, that was on TV here at home, you know, a few years back, so I think she died at the time. But it was a very pleasant interlude, really. And then we went from Cape Town round to Durban. We stayed there, out on the racecourse, where we were billeted under canvas. Pretty ad-lib, going into town, doing what we wanted to do. There was a particular cafe there where you get a cup of tea and as much as you could eat for a shilling. That sort of situation, which was better food than we were getting in the camp. That was about it, really. We had nothing really laid on in the trading line.
And then you had another voyage up to Port Said, you said.
Yeah, Port Suez.
Port Suez.
Yes.
What was your first impression of Egypt?
Flat and sandy. And my first impression wasn't a good one, because the first night there, we had a gale blow. I don't know if you've ever been in a gale in the Middle East. It's painful. And we settled down for the night under canvas. During the night, it was blowing about all over the show. We were all covered in sand. Your hair gets all matted up with sand. It's a horrible feeling, there's no doubt about it. So that was my introduction to Egypt. I didn't really think much of it. It was flat, it was sandy, and very little greenery around, and even by the canal there, where there's plenty of water. Ishmaelia, I don't know if you know Ishmaelia. That is sort of midway between Port Suez and Port Said. There was quite a big encampment of troops in Ishmaelia.
Where was the PT school?
The PT school at that time was in this first place we went to, the name of which I cannot remember. Yeah. And then it moved to Giza. That's up by the pyramids.
Yeah. What sort of facilities did it have, the Middle East PT school?
Well, it didn't have a gymnasium for a start. The world was the gymnasium. I was posted to the school from the canal side, the number 2 convalescent depot. I went to the school as sergeant major of the Indian wing of the Middle East PT school.
Yes.
I suppose they looked at my record and said he's done 9 years in India, should be able to speak the language. It's far from the truth. I probably knew a little bit more than a lot of other people. That was about all, I suppose. But we had, of course, what you had in the Middle East is what you made. You had to use your own ingenuity. It's the same in a lot of places, let alone the Middle East. And in no time at all, you've built yourself a jolly good obstacle course. You marked out a ground for games. In between that, you're doing endurance tests, so there's nothing like endurance in sand, particularly if you're trying to go uphill in sand. So there was plenty of things that they did do and could do.
Were there any differences in the sort of PT you were doing which were taking account of local conditions?
No. Take your PT tables. It doesn't matter where you were, they were the PT tables, they were the ones you did. The same with everything else in the PT line.
Did the Indians do exactly the same as the British troops?
Almost the same, but they played games different to us. I don't know if you've heard it on PT at all, but they play a game called Kabaddi.
Tell me about Kabaddi.
Kabaddi is rather like a badminton court, and the middle line, and one side on the net side, this say net side, the same as it would be as for a badminton court, but it might not be a net there, could be a line on the ground. And they've got to try and touch the ball down in the other person's half to score. and you're on your own going on comedy, 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 comedy. Now, that again was shown on TV not so long ago. You'll probably see it again because the Indians are getting more and more, or the Asians in particular, in general, are getting more and more forward going in this country than any other nation.
How was their fitness compared to that of the British troops you were training?
I wouldn't say there was a lot of difference between one and t'other. They're wiry little people, the Indians, but of course, with the Indian wing out there, there was Indians, Gurkhas, well, every sort of religion you could think of was mixed up with the Indian wing students. But,
did they have a different attitude to physical training in any way, these different groups of Indians?
No, they were very good, actually. I mean, if anything, they probably lashed into it a bit more than the English troops did. I always think that coloured people, they seem to have a bit of a chip on their shoulder. They've just got to do better than the white people. Life is not worth living if they can't do something better than the white person. I think they're their own enemy in most cases.
What about handling them? Because as a sergeant major, you'd be really involved in managing and supervising.
Yeah, well,
you?
I had four or five. Oh no, I had more than that. There was about six instructors, I suppose. I had.
Would they be sergeants?
There was two sergeants, and the others were corporals. Yeah. I've got a photograph of them somewhere. I'm sitting there in the middle of them, and I'm blacker than they are.
and did you find that, I mean, when you were dealing with them, did you deal with them in exactly the same way as you would have done with British NCOs?
Exactly the same way. It don't make any difference.
They had the same mentality.
Yeah. As I say, they were no bother. They were, if anything, I probably would rather, on some occasions, take them or instruct them than what I would instruct British people.
What was your main business then as Sergeant Major of the Indian Wing? What were your duties and what were you doing?
To make sure that the instructors I had there that do their job.
Yes.
By that you did that by observation, obviously.
Yeah.
And where it was going wrong, to step in and put it right, really. It was a question of just keeping the thing going under the right way.
And they were training instructors to go out to battalions?
They were going to be assistant instructors out in their units once they'd been trained up. Yeah. It was a bit of a job getting all of them trained. It spent a lot of time in training troops to go back and be assistant instructors of PT.
Yes.
I flew up to Benghazi to take some junior NCOs on PT so that when I left they could carry on with the PT work. And that was a nice outing for me, up to Benghazi and back to Cairo again.
How long would it take to actually train a soldier up to become an assistant instructor in PT? How long did you give them in your Middle East school?
Well, let me just say what I used to do. Now, wherever I went and I needed assistant instructors, I'd always be on the lookout for an assistant instructor. First and foremost, I'd watch the squads doing their PT. And if there was anybody outstanding, there's always somebody outstanding in these things, you keep an eye on them. If he proves after a period of time that your thoughts about him is right, then you can apply for him to have an assistant instructor's course either at the PT school or at one of the other units that do instructing. Now, I'm just trying to think. The Tidworth, again, I must come back to. See, they ran assistant instructor courses, so anybody in that area who needed a course, they would go there rather than send them all the way to Aldershot. So it wasn't necessarily just one place where they were instructed. It was quite a few places, really.
And how long would it take? How long would a course run for?
Again, about a month. Ample time to train the lad up. Remember, you sorted him out from among the others. He's better than the others. So he's going to be just a question of a bit of confidence in instructing more than anything else.
Did you ever find that units tried to hang on to people that you wanted to take away on courses?
Never. No. They all seemed to be quite happy about it. After all, they were going to get the bloke back. He was a bit more efficient. I mean, he could go there as a private soldier and prove himself worthy of a stripe and come back and get promotion on it as well.
What could you do when you weren't working? What recreational facilities did you have?
Well, your own recreational facilities you looked after to do what you wanted to do, really. But I used to enjoy going to football, going to hockey, basketball. Where possible, I would have a game. As a matter of fact, my last game of basketball, I was 40 years of age, I think, when I last played there. It's one of the fastest games on foot.
Well, it depends on who's playing.
Pardon?
It depends on who's playing.
That's right, yeah.
What about going off, you know, off the camp or out of the school? What did Egypt have to offer in the way of facilities?
Well, outside of Cairo and Alexandria, very little, I suppose. That's where people went if they wanted a night out, if they were within reach of him, but they were very wide apart. And as can well imagine, most troops stations were well out in the desert.
But you were at Giza, weren't you, for quite a while?
I was at Giza for a while, and from Giza I went up to Gaza. So it was a Giza and a Gaza. Again, what happened is the PT school moved from Giza to Gaza. That's why I went up there. From there, I went to join a South African unit for a while. Can't remember where it was.
What did you make of them?
Not good soldiers.
Really? Why not?
Not from a British point of view, good soldiers. But the sergeant was Tom and the officer was Dick. And you had this, for instance, I was involved in an accident in Palestine, as it was then. I lost my two front teeth.
Yes.
I couldn't get them replaced by British medical officers because it was beauty treatment. But the first night I was in the science mess of this South African unit, one of the chaps there said to me, "What's wrong with your teeth?" I said, "Well, I've just had them knocked out." "Well, why haven't you got false ones?" So I explained to him. "Now, I work in the dental section," he said. "Now, you come and see me tomorrow morning." And the next morning I went along to where he pointed out to me. They're talking to him for about 5 minutes. The officer came in and he said, "Here, Dick, this is that chap I want you to do something about." And, you know, within days I had false teeth. They were the sort of people they were. They were issued with a bag of goodies each month, I think. It's usually a packet of fags, toothpaste, all that sort of thing. Things that were going to be handed to you, not likely to get. And they included me in the issue of these when I was with them, which was very, very nice.
What about their physical condition?
I didn't have enough to do with them to pass any comment.
Oh, I see.
So I went from them to the RA depot at out in the desert from Cairo. What was it? I can't remember the name of it. A bit confusing, all these names, yes, particularly when they're foreign ones. You don't keep them in line.
Did you find the artillery had exactly the same requirements for fitness as the infantry?
Oh, yes.
They weren't particularly interested in upper body strength or anything like that.
No, they were treated exactly the same way as anybody else. Mm. Their gymnasium was a little bit of desert, same as anybody else.
Yes.
But there we had a few more things. We had some parallel bars and horizontal bars there. Mm. So we could do a bit of gymnastics.
Did you have any opportunity to travel while you were in Palestine and get an impression of the country?
No, we did have one day off, I think it was. The courses had ended on a particular day and they weren't going to start again for a couple of days afterwards, so we had a day off. And having the day off, I did a trip up to Jerusalem. And that was worth every moment of effort to go and do that. I was really impressed by Jerusalem, there's no doubt about it. It's something I feel that all people should go and do. Have a trip round and have the various stops of the good Lord as he went up to be crucified.
Did you walk the station to the cross then?
Yes.
You did?
Mm. Yes, we walked right the way through to the church. The church, they got the marks there where the crosses were supposed to have stood. One has to take a lot of that with a pinch of salt, I think. Mm. But it certainly made me think, and I felt that it had been wet every bit... something I would like to do again, actually.
Did you have any contact with the population at all?
Very little. So quite a few work around the camp. You knew them, of course. And they were the best thieves I've ever met in my life.
Ah.
they were all loose swallows.
This being in Egypt rather than Palestine?
Right the way through, really.
All the way through?
Yeah, very bad. At the back end of the war, they transferred a lot of prisoners of war from Russia home. And the way they brought them home was from Russia, or they were going to bring them home, from Russia to Alexander, and Alexander home. Now what they did, they knew the numbers of prisoners that were coming, but weren't sure how many of them would come together or whether they'd be split up. So they had to back two horses, really. At Alexander, they opened up a camp. So if a number of troops came from Russia and they were disembarked there, and there was more ex-prisoners there than there was transport to take them, then they could move them out to the camp they'd opened up for them. I took a squad of instructors out to there and we laid all this camp on, asked me what I wanted in the way of material, so I had to get footballs, hockey balls, hockey sticks, strips and so on and so forth to last for so long. And we put all this stuff in a bungalow. It was up there, one night, and the next night when we went along, they'd all gone. God knows how many thousands of pounds worth of kit had gone. But the other thing was, on this first night there, was that we had to do the labouring work in the camp, Italian prisoners of war. And these thieves went through the barrack block that the prisoners of war were in and took everything they'd got, except for what they slept in, without waking any of them up. They were a funny looking lot, you know, when they turned out with all their nightshirts or whatever. They were quite laughable, really.
How did you get on with your Italian prisoners of war?
They were quite all right, really. When we were at the convalescent depot, they did all the cooking and things like that. And they seemed to be a pleasant lot, really. They always hear them singing in under their canvas, and that they're quite good. And while I was there, I did run a boxing tournament for them against each other, not against, just against each other. That went down extremely well with blokes in the camp as well as them.
Did the prisoners of war arrive eventually, the ones coming back from Russia?
Did
the prisoners of war from Russia arrive?
No. We didn't see them. The camp was opened up for nothing. But it was there in case it was needed. That was the original intention, of course.
Yes.
But it wasn't needed. It just closed the thing down. Yeah. After this theft, we got in touch with the local police, and most of these countries who have local police like that, that you usually find that the sergeants are usually British, as India, all through the Middle East or whatever, Palestine in particular. Lo and behold, this sergeant turns up with a couple of his policemen,